the React Native is going to be the kind of like the future, because what we can do is we can share the code between the iOS app and also Android app.
Hello and welcome to React Native Radio, episode 14. Today on our panel, we have Peter Pykarczyk.
Hey, everyone.
Kevin Ohl.
Hello.
Lee Johnson.
How's it going?
And I'm Nader Dabit. Today, our special guest is Ali Najifzadeh. Ali, would you like to introduce yourself and give us a quick background about yourself?
Hello, my name is Ali Najifzadeh, and I live in Canada, Toronto, a cold weather, I guess. And I love React Native and Redux. I originally from Iran. I moved to Canada 10 years ago. I studied computer science, software engineer, 4 years bachelor degree. And then I did my master degree. And then in 2011, I got my first job in Canada. So after 3 years, I moved out to another company, which is my current job. It's Presley. Presley.com. So I hired as a full stack developer. The reason I actually moved there is I love JavaScript, but I wanted a little bit of change because I used to be a Java programmer and I wanted to explore the JavaScript. So, and also I wanted to do Golang as well. So I found Presley and then I joined the team as a full stack developer. So I helped them at the back end and also front end. It was around like April that I was hired by Presley. And around like May, I was talking to my CTO and then they decided to go with React Native. So at that date, React Native was pretty new and hot and also very fragile, I guess version 5, like 0.5. So I started working on it and there was a lot of bug actually inside it. So we're slowly building our application and we realized that it's not going to scale if you're going that way. So I started looking around. I found, I used Flux before. So I introduced the Flux into our application, but I saw a lot of boilerplate. And I decided to find some other framework. And then I found Reflux. So Reflux is a better, and it's just basically doing a lot of things behind the scene for you. It's similar to Marionette and Backbone. So like if you're working with the Backbone and then suddenly Marionette is actually doing a lot of things for you and managing a lot of things. So Reflux is kind of like a Marionette version of the Flux. And I started using that one. But then I started realizing that I'm still doing something like too much. And then I started looking at that and then we found Redux. At that time, Redux was around like in maybe 200 stars, something like that. So I said, okay, that's pretty cool. So I spent one weekend and then convert the entire project into Redux. And that's how I started. So I started using Redux. The only problem that I had before was I had to fork the React Native for a couple of months because it wasn't actually compatible with Redux at that time. So I used my fork version for the production. And then I guess until recently, they released 0.18, which you don't need any patch version anymore. And then you can just freely using Redux. So,
hey, Ali, can you talk a little bit about the incompatibilities with Redux and React Native that you were seeing before? What did you have to go around? How were you able to solve that?
Well, a couple of them was about the packager that React Native introduces at the very beginning because they didn't use regular node modules. So, and also they used some sort of like a Babel, like a kind of like a fork version of the Babel. I still don't understand it properly, but so what I had to do, at least, because if you start using a Redux, you don't want to go back and start writing a ES5, for example, like a JavaScript code. It makes it a little bit harder to work with, like if you're trying to create a state. So my fork was just basically adding ES6 and ES7 into the actual core of the React Native. It wasn't that much code. It just basically some part of it was needed to be replaced. But for example, one of the easiest things is when you're actually using the import. Well, first of all, import wasn't available until, I guess, 0.8, I think. I might be wrong. And so all you have to do is you have to use required all the time. And the other problem that I had with the React Native back then was if you have a multi-line inside your import, the way that they parse it, they couldn't handle it. So there was a bug inside the regular expression. So we have to actually add enter key at the end of the regular expression so they can actually parse the import, so they can extract it. So these are the basic part of it. And I think that would be it until, I guess, 0.17, all the way until 0.17. And then on 0.18, the React Native announced that they're going to use React as the internal code, which is a good thing because they used the fork version of the React. Again, I guess they modified some code inside the React that actually works better, I guess, with the React Native. So, but React Redux 4 was only compatible with, I guess, React 14. So by recent change, they introduced, it would be a lot easier to actually work with. So what I end up doing is I start creating a project. It's called example of a counter, I guess, in my repo. And I start versioning it so I can tell people how to start creating a React Native alongside with Redux. And then I basically document everything over there. Like, if you really want to use this one, make sure that, okay, I start to remember one more thing. So the last problem that I still have with the React Native is if you're using NPM version 2, because version 3 is actually flattened the entire node modules folder, you don't have actually a problem. But with NPM version 2, it actually creates a deep hierarchy node module. So every modules can actually bring their own version of the React. And that caused a problem with Redux. And also Babel.js as well. There is a file called Babel.rc. So I think Redux still have a couple of them. So if you're actually using a NPM version 2 and then you're trying to run it, it tries to give you an error that Babel.rc actually exists. And then Babel tries to compile it. So it just basically, it's a lot of simple and small problems that you have to actually fix. So I end up creating a bash script to actually remove all the bash Babel.rc from the project and also to actually get it to run. So it's kind of like a try and error, finding the actual problems. But if you're actually using an NPM version 3, you should be fine. So you don't actually need to do all of this crazy hacks, I guess.
Awesome. That's good to know just sometimes what the hacks are, because I know that when you're starting a project, you might not always be able to upgrade to the latest versions immediately. So it's always good to know what you have to do to get around those.
Yeah. So these are the things that I already communicate with the React team, and they are planning to do this. I guess Dan, the creator of Redux, has already removed a couple of Babel.rc from his project. But he was mentioning that there was a problem in Babel 6 because when they released the Babel 6, they basically rewrite the entire thing and then things becomes a little bit harder, I guess. Because, for example, I was a fan of Decorator. And then Babel 6 released and they said, oh yeah, because decorators are not released yet and it's still in draft and we don't know whether we're going to put it into the JavaScript or not for the version 7. We're not going to implement it. So, and by having a decorators and working with the Redux, you can actually have a better syntax. So you just basically put a connector on top of your class and make it a kind of like a smart component. So now what you have to do is you just have to call a connect function and then just basically pass in your class there. So it would be nice if somebody actually create some sort of like a, I was actually about to write a plugin to attach it to the Babel 6 so it can actually start parsing the Babel 6 decorators, but I haven't actually had the time to actually start writing it. But it would be a very nice project if somebody can actually do it, to actually bring the decorators into the Babel 6.
So what kind of mobile application are you guys building at your company, or what type of app are you using React Native for?
We built the app from the scratch, so it's not being released yet. It's still in kind of like beta release. So we only publish it to our close customers. So it's not actually available in App Store. So what we did is we also, in order for you to understand what we actually build, Presley is similar to what we are building as kind of like a Reddit for the business. So they can actually post their links, and then we are basically maintaining the entire code. Like, for example, you paste a link, we just going the backend actually going into the website, extract every single details from that website. And then they offer you, so you can actually start curating a content. And a lot of people are starting using our platform as a beta testers. And they always ask us, okay, can we actually do this type of things in mobile app? And then we start using a React Native at the very beginning because we know that the React Native is going to be the kind of like the future, because what we can do is we can share the code between the iOS app and also Android app. I guess this is kind of like a dream of all mobile developers.
Yeah, definitely.
They just want to share some code. Like, of course, the UI is going to be different, and the interactions of the two different things are going to be different. But we can actually share some business logic. Like, for example, all the stores, Redux stores and Redux actions and everything is going to be shareable. And also some of the components can be also shareable. So as we progress through our app, we start releasing, open sourcing a lot of things to the public. Like, for example, one of the problems that we have in React Native is Navigator. So we used to, like, our web app is kind of like using a React router. We love React router so much, and then we miss it in React Native, because the only thing that you have in React Native is Navigator, so by default. And so what we did is we start implementing something called Scene Router, which is, it has the similar syntax as React Router, but it's available for mobile applications. So you can actually basically navigate to different scenes with a path, a regular URL path, which also gives you a really powerful concept of deep linking as well. So deep linking is something like somebody actually, like from the browser, you can just basically open the app, and then you can just navigate to that specific scene by just having the URL.
That sounds pretty interesting. How did you guys get that to work?
So what we did is I was taking a look at the whole project, and then I studying the React router as internal, and I extract some part of it, like the concept. So we create a route system from the scratch. It's based on try, or some people call it tree, T-R-I-E structure. So we build the entire route and path based on the try binary. It's kind of like a try tree. And then we attach each scene to the end of each leaves. So when you're actually passing a path, we start parsing it until we found that scene, and then we just navigate to that scene. That part, it's very simple, to be honest with you. The hardest part is getting the animation to work on both devices. Because what happened is it works perfectly fine in iOS. Like, we had a very good result in iOS. But once the Android is released, we realized, okay, let's just test it with it's a similar code. We don't actually touch anything. We're still using a Vue. So as soon as we put the scene router inside the Android, it kind of like crashes. And then we started thinking, okay, what's going on? And then we started taking a look at it in depth inside it. And then we realized that, okay, the cache is kind of like a memory leak. So we fixed that. And then, but we start realizing that none of our scenes are actually being displayed. There is no, it's kind of like a white screen. So we deep dive into it. And then we realized that all the views inside the React Native on Android are, I think it's overflow hidden by default. And that's one of the features that is being added to, I guess, version 16 and above. So by that time, we realized, oh, that's kind of bad, because when everything is overflow hidden, it becomes, you have to basically pass width and height to every single scene that we are using. So we start experimenting with different things to actually animating from one scene to another. So that's how we end up. Eventually, we get it to work, but the performance is still around like a 50 frames per second. So we wanted to get it to the 60 frame per second. So it's good enough for most applications, but still a little bit, we can actually do better. So we are hoping that in the future, if the React team or React Native team can actually improve the animated API, because we are heavily using animated API in the Scene Router to do the animations. So you can basically, and it's kind of like I try to actually put a lot of documentations inside the Scene Router. Yeah, that's it. So I love everyone actually take a look at it, give us feedback.
And you guys open source that, right? So it's available now?
Yeah, it is open source now. It's under Presley/Scene Router on GitHub account.
Okay. Well, I think it's pretty huge because a lot of people seem to be going from React Web to React Mobile, and React Router something they're familiar with. So I think that would definitely help. I know in our experience getting familiar with React Native, I think the Navigator is something that is a roadblock. And I think Kevin has spoken about it in the past, about it being just weird if you're not,
yeah,
you know, just if you're coming from a router URL world, that's just a weird concept to push and pull scenes to this thing.
Right, yeah. I had the pleasure to come up with an iOS developer alongside me, so he could explain the concepts from iOS and how the Navigator worked there, which was completely foreign to me with a web background, simply relying on URLs. Yeah, it was. So this, what you guys have built here, this Scene Router, is really something I'm going to take a look at, because I think it helps glue what we know as web developers, and a lot of people are coming from the web to React Native. So this is really looks really awesome.
Yeah, thanks. This is kind of like the things that we're still working on it and we are iterating over it. But if people can start using it and we can get more use cases from the people, and then we can just improve it. That's why we actually open source it. But like we said, at the very first thing, our CTO was basically pushing that we need to open source as many things as we can, because we're using open source, we should contribute back to the open source. So also what we also did during the process of building our applications, we build a bridge between React Native and WebView. So let's say if you embedded the WebView and then you want to have a communications between your React Native code and your JavaScript that is being loaded by a web inside your mobile app, how would you actually communicate? So I started looking around and I found that, okay, there is none out there. So I said, okay, let's just build one. So I started building that one as well. So, and it's pretty good so far. It requires a little bit of binding, like native binding. But right now the iOS version is ready. I had also a couple of pull requests for the Android. So hopefully by maybe 1 or 2 weeks, we're going to have that one ready as well. So
now what's that one called?
It's React Native WebView Bridge.
That one looks super exciting to me. So what you're saying is I could load a WebView from within a React Native app and then have my React Native app talk to my React inside that WebView app?
Yes, that is correct.
Now, that is some really cool stuff. Do you have any use cases or anything cool that you've done with it so far to kind of expand on that? I know you're just getting started with it, but yeah, anything you could share so far?
There is one other project which we have the native side ready, but we haven't actually open sourced it, but we actually released the backend of it. Well, a couple of months ago, I started working on a project because I was looking at the React Native because I wanted to actually auto-upload my application into mobile. So let's say I don't want to basically go through the App Store whole 2 weeks process just to fix a typo or just changing a simple bug. So we thought it would be cool, like at the very beginning, before other products came along, it would be really cool if we can actually upload our application directly to mobile devices. Like, let's say a new update came in, like we implement a new modules in JavaScript, so we can just basically ship it to our customer right away. So I start basically hacking things, and I kind of like love Golang. I know this talk is not about Golang, so So I started implementing everything in Golang. And then for now, we're releasing the server side. So what you have to do is you just basically open a DigitalOcean on like $5, and you just basically run your server there. And then you're just basically pushing your applications into that server. And then the server is just basically pushing it to other React Native part. So that's the things that we're working on it to get it ready by kind of like in 1 month or so. So the server side is ready. We're working on the actual mobile parts of it so they can actually communicate with the server. So one of the reasons I start building that one is I look at the App Hub, and I guess Microsoft released Code Push, and there was another one, I guess, came with. And all of them are kind of like a service, paid service. So you have to pay some money in order to actually do this. And I said, yeah, it's cool. It's cool. Everything and everyone is actually going to the cloud. So they're basically talking, oh, yeah, we are maintaining your applications. You can just do this. I said, yeah, it's good. But paying kind of like a $300 just for pushing my application, it's not cool. And I want to actually make it as an open source. Everything becomes available to everyone so everyone can actually use it. So I start building that application, and then we open source it. We call it for now Selfie. So it's under Presley account. So Presley/Selfie under our GitHub account. Right now it's just the server side, but we are planning to release the web UI and also the native side, which is Android and React Native part. So you can actually use that one to push your code directly to the customer.
Oh, that's cool. It sounds like you guys are doing quite a bit of open source work, huh?
Oh, yeah. We love open source. So that's like the entire R stack is kind of like built on open source. I don't think any other startup actually not using the open source. That's our, and then we are like, our concept is if you're using open source, you have to contribute back to the open source community. So we're trying to do that as much as we can.
You said that you were enjoying using Go. Are you guys using Go for like some of your backend services for your React Native app? And if so, can you kind of go into like why you think it's a good fit?
Yeah. So at the very beginning, the backend of Presley was Ruby. But then they decided to, well, I wasn't actually part of it at the very beginning, but they decided to use Go. And Presley is the host of Go Meetup in Toronto. So we have actually a meetup place. So if anyone wants to actually join the Go community in Toronto, they can basically hop in. We have a Go Meetup every 6 weeks. And then we plan to actually do that every 6 weeks. But our backend is purely Go. And they basically rewrite the entire Ruby and then convert it in Go. And one of the reason is, one of the big reason is when you compile Go, it just gives you a single file. And then you just basically put that single file into the server and you just run it. There is no dependency. There is no NPM install. Let me just install all the modules from the server or put it into the Docker and then push it in. You just basically place that single executable file on a server side and then you just run it. Of course, you can just basically scale it. Like, for example, you can basically put that single file inside a Docker and run it multiple times on a different servers. But the whole concept of it is it's a single binary file that contains all the libraries and runtimes and everything. So it's not like a Java that you need to install the JVM in order to get it to run. You just basically put the one single binary and it works perfectly fine. And the second part is the compiler is amazingly fast. Like you just compile the entire thing from the source in less than maybe 5 seconds if it's very, very huge project. And usually 5 seconds is just, I've never seen a project actually, well, with my experience, I haven't seen any project actually compiles less than 5 seconds. So it's pretty good. So you can just basically bring everything over and then you can just basically compile. And the community of the Go is also pretty impressive. Like everyone is contributing. So Yeah, and I'm suggesting like give Go a chance, and then it will prove it to you, and then you can actually use it in your backend.
That's cool. You early on you had mentioned going from Flux to Reflux to Redux, and I think I know that we've kind of experienced the same path. I guess could you kind of explain a little bit of the differences between the three? I know you kind of explained some of the challenges of getting Redux working, and probably now with the current version, it's not a big deal. But just the way that it works, because I know there's some state issues that are different. There's some boilerplate code that you don't have to worry about, and those kinds of things. But I think it's a pretty common flow for someone to go from Flux to something like Reflux and then want to try Redux.
Yeah, so one of the things that I learned about the Redux that I love it, that I just wanted to, like, I think it would be good, like, for everyone from moving from Flux to Redux directly. You don't have to actually go through the Reflux. By the time, like, the reason I did that because at that time, Redux was around, like, 100 stars. And I said, okay, it's not mature enough. Let me just give that project another month or so to see how it actually performs. So I started implementing everything in Reflux. So Reflux is not that bad. Like I'm not saying that Reflux is it's not a good library. It's actually a decent library. And if you are actually using a Reflux in your project, it is okay to keep using it. Like I don't see any problems with Reflux. One of the good things that I found that Redux brings into the table is simplicity and a pure function. And it just basically tells you we're not doing any magic. I used to be a fan of Angular, so I'm not basically smashing Angular. Angular is still perfect, but Angular is doing a lot of magic behind the scene. I don't see anything. Like, as a programmer, I need to understand, okay, what's going on? Like, if I do this, why it's not binding into the my, like, let's say HTML? Like, what's going on? Like, I couldn't actually see this type of thing. With Redux, you can actually see everything. And the entire source code is, I guess, it's around like a 10K, or it's maybe less than a 3,000. Like, it's not even 3,000 lines of code, like maybe 1,000 lines of code. So if you're just going through it, and also Dan, the creator of the Redux, he also published a bunch of videos on how you actually write a Redux application. And I recommend to everyone to go to the egghead.io or something and download all of those in your mobile phone and start watching it every time. Like, I'm actually downloaded on phone and every time I actually go to work. I have a little bit of long commute to work, but in this time, I'm actually start watching it. And every time I watch it, I learn something new. Like, even though I know Redux and I know how it works, but the way that he described it, it makes it you want to actually go and write the application in Redux. So one of the good thing about Redux is, first of all, it's simplicity. And also, you just write a function. And then function just accepts an action and also the state of your application. And then that action just change something inside the state, return a brand new state, and you just basically chaining a bunch of stores together, and then you creating your state of your application. And then pass that complete state of your application into the root node of your React or React Native application. And then each component is going to change based on that specific state. At the very first thing, you might ask yourself, okay, if I put everything into the very large state, is it a good idea? How do I maintain it? It would be very hard to organize it. So that's how you structure your applications into the two different types. Well, the very first type, I call it a structure, type of structures that you can actually do is, we call it an action base. So it means that it's kind of like similar to the Flux architecture. So you create a file, call it action, and then you put all the action name as a string, and whatever you want to do, like let's say to-do list. So you just basically say add a to-do. And then you just basically list all the actions that you want to do as a map of a string. So the key and the value of that actions are actually the same. And then you create a folder called actions, and then you write down the entire actions inside it. And then you separate them by the name of the actions. Let's say you just basically say the action, one of the action would be to do, for example. So it means that that action is related to the to-do list. So just basically adding or removing. And then you create another folder called reducers. And then inside that reducer, you create the same name to-do, which react based on that action. So you create your project structures like this. We used to do this, but then we start seeing we are actually repeating ourselves multiple times. And it wasn't actually good enough until we found another project, which is kind of like a new idea of how you organize your Redux. So it was called, well, the creator is, I hope I pronounced his last name correctly, but his name is Eric Rasmussen. And he creates a repository called Dux and dash Redux Reducer Bundles. So what he was describing that instead of doing this type of things, like the traditional Flux way of doing this, what you can do is use some sort of like, he actually did a very smart move. So what he did is he said, okay, we're going to go with the kind of like a modular base. So to me, modular base is kind of like a feature base. So I'm just basing his head saying that I'm going to put all my action types, all my actions, and a single reducer inside a single file. Now you might ask, okay, why are you doing this? And I'm telling you, it's, first of all, it's kind of like encapsulations, because node modules by default is kind of like a, you can encapsulate everything inside a file. So by default, I don't really care about the, I don't want to expose the actions types to the different features. Like it doesn't make sense, because actions can only triggers those action types. And the way that he did is he exports all the actions and then he export default of the reducer. So inside your node modules, like in ES6, if you use export alone, it just basically adds it into the a map. But if you're actually using an export default, it adds it into the actual file. So when you require that modules without any parentheses, like a curly brackets, you get a reducer. If you don't use the, if you use the curly bracket inside it, like you can mention the action names. And then you, in this way, you can actually make, you can create a very nice structure of your application. So he described this one inside his repository. And since then, we started using it. And then it actually works pretty well in our big project. We have around 25 reducers and a lot of actions, and probably it's around like 100 actions. And the action types is just similar. It's kind of like 80 to 90 actions. And then by doing that, we just basically modularizing our action and reducers into the single file. So every time I want to modify a single file, I can just jump into the specific file, and I know that this file contains everything, so I can just basically navigate to it. What also you can do is, if you don't like putting everything into the one file, you can basically create a folder, and then you can just break down everything inside that folder. And then you can basically create three different files. One file is kind of like your actions, so all of your actions are going to be inside it. And then use the index.js to navigate into it. So I'll suggest everyone actually take a look at his repository. It's easy to find, and it's good to see the different types of implementation. Well, organizing your Redux application.
So, and React Native with Redux, are you able to do the combined reducers and all of those same functions that you can use in the desktop web Redux implementation?
Yeah. All of them can be done. So, if you're using a React Native 0.18. Above 18, you have to use a React Native, Redux, the latest Redux, and then React Redux 4. because React Redux 4 is require React 14. And by React Native 18, they embedded the latest version of the React, which Redux actually uses. So, but if you're using a below that version, like below 0.18, you have to use a Redux. Well, you can use the latest Redux, but you can't use the latest React Redux because Redux is not specific to, people need to understand that Redux is not React specific framework. Redux is just a universal framework. You can just use it for any other applications. You can just use it with Angular. You can just use it with Backbone. There is a project, there's another project called React Redux, which binds the React or React Native to Redux. So you don't have to actually writing a lot of code. You can just basically using an existing framework.
So on the topic of, just Redux being universal, have you used Redux on the server? I know you guys are using Go, but have you experimented with the Redux pattern on server-side development?
It's a very interesting topic, and we are actually thinking about it, but we haven't done anything yet, because usually on the server side, when somebody actually talking about the server side, you can just basically tell, okay, my store is actually my database. And all the actions that actually happens is basically touching the database and then changing the state inside the database. By bringing Redux into a server side, we need some sort of like a brand new concept, which it's kind of like different. Like, I don't know how it's going to look like, because the state of your application on a server, how do you define it? Like, if you expose it as a REST API, how would you, like, and every single REST API is connected, like, it has its own thread. And so it's kind of like a different concept, but it would be nice if somebody or even us can actually come up with a very interesting concept of using Redux. To be honest with you, Redux is actually not the first library that actually does that. I think Elm, there was another language called Elmlang, which is kind of like a Haskell type. And it's created by Evan, I can't pronounce his last name, it's just too difficult for me. But he actually creates a kind of like a action update view concept. And there is a very large tutorial based on the Elm architecture. So when you actually take a look at the Elm architecture, you will see that there is a very similar concept between the Redux and Elm. And as a matter of fact, I think Dan, the creator of the Redux, back in a couple of months ago, he was mentioning that he basically grabbed some concept from Elm, but don't quote me that. So I would just...
No, you're correct. Yeah, you're correct. He did borrow the ideas from Elm and just brought them over to JavaScript. So the information I heard, he's been on a couple of podcasts and was talking about the fact that he had seen people go over to Elm and stay, and he wanted to bring that back to JavaScript. So he basically brought that implementation over as far as we can, because Elm is strictly typed and so forth. So we don't have the exact compiler that they have, but Redux, in my opinion, is pretty close. I would like to have, may get into using Flow and add some typing that may help tighten things down a little bit. But yeah, you're exactly right. He borrowed those ideas, but I think there was one thing that I didn't catch it. I need to go back and rewatch it. But on one of the interviews, he said that at first he didn't, in his talk at React Europe, he didn't give credit to Evan, the creator of Elm, and didn't mention in the talk that he borrowed these ideas. But it's now in the documentation.
I started taking a look at the Elm, and Elm is also pretty interesting. So also highly, you don't have to learn anything, like, even though it's kind of like a subset of Haskell, and usually people saying that Haskell is extremely and harsh to learn. And but I found Elm to be very enjoyable. So as soon as you start writing an Elm application, you don't want to stop. And I don't know why. Like, it just mesmerizing you with the syntax, and then you start writing simple functions that they just don't mutate, and you can have a side effect. And to be honest with you, it has the most polite compiler ever. So it just basically tells you, oh, by the way, would you please fix this one for me before I actually compile it? So instead of like a C, like for example, if you work with the C compiler just basically said, I don't know, it just something is broke up. You did something wrong. And they just basically dump a lot of binary code, like a hash, like a hexadecimal code. And then you just have to figure out, okay, what went wrong. But based on my experience, like I did maybe 2 or 3 weeks of experimenting with Elm. I found that if your program actually compiles, 95% of the time, it actually works perfectly fine. It runs. And based on the creator of Elm, it never crashes. So like because it has a type safety, it knows exactly that the function will accept only numbers. And so no matter what you do, it doesn't actually crash unless you actually pass, you're dividing 2 numbers and then you pass something that it's not supposed to be there. But usually it doesn't have the problems that JavaScript has. So in JavaScript, we are just too dynamic. And I still love being too dynamic because I want to, like, say, create a function and then pass whatever things that I want to the function. But for a large project, it will bite you back. So I guess people have to use the right way. Like use the right tools for the right job. So I'm not pushing people to use Elm, but it's a nice tools to work with.
Okay, cool. Well, we're going to probably wrap it up here in a couple of minutes. But before we do, I wanted to ask you a question. If someone wanted to kind of get started with Redux, with a React Native app, I know you have a repo out there. What's the best way for someone to get started? Should they clone your repo or should they start a new React Native project and try to implement it from scratch? Or what would you suggest?
Well, I guess the very first thing people need to do is first understand the Redux. And I highly recommend watching the Dan's videos. It's only around like a 1.5 hours, 2 hours. It's around like a 30 videos. And each video is, I guess, 3 minutes. So it's not that hard you can just basically learn the entire Redux. And then he actually, inside the talk, you can actually write the entire Redux, kind of like the core, by just writing it. Like he just explained every single lines of code. And then that simplicity makes you actually start writing the application. So I guess the very first one is learning the actual Redux. Don't worry about the React Native or React. After that, you can either clone my project because it has just a simple example. It's just a counter example that just fires an actions and it just changes the state and it will render that state. So you can just clone that project. You can just work with it. And usually I'm pretty active in my GitHub account. Any issues that I've actually been released, I will be notified right away. And I'd rather answer all the questions on a GitHub account. My GitHub accounts or even on Presley, and I'm also available on Stack Overflow. So if anybody have any questions about the Redux, I will try my best to answer it. But definitely learn the Redux first, forget about the React Native, and then learn the concept. And then either clone my projects or create everything from scratch. It's not that hard to learn. And then at the very beginning, you might ask yourself, oh, maybe I'm actually doing too much, but I guess it will pay off at the end.
Okay, awesome. Well, I guess we'll go ahead and get to our picks. Our picks are going to go ahead and start, I guess. So, Lee, would you like to go ahead with your pick?
Sure. My pick this week is TrackJS. We recently started using it for beta testing an application, and it will detect all of your JavaScript errors or warnings and send it to a server for you and aggregate it all and even tell you kind of the sequence of how it happened. You can attach user IDs. So it's a really good debugging tool, and it's, you can really quickly and easily set it up so that when in production, nothing gets written to the console and everything gets written to the server. I know in native world, you don't worry about the console so much, but we like to do a lot of sharing between web and native. So I think it's a good tool to kind of aggregate all your errors and problems in one place for both or any JavaScript application. So it's TrackJS.
Okay, great. Ali?
So I'm actually picking up a project that my team in a backend at Presley, we're working on it. It's called SUP. It has nothing to do, it returns in Go, but it has nothing to do with Go. So what it does is just basically, if you have multiple servers, and then you want to basically talk to them at the same time by just using one terminal, you can use this tool, and then you can just basically start deploying, getting a log. And we found out that this tool is actually helping us a lot in terms of the deploying, getting a log from the server. I love everyone actually started using it. We got a lot of stars, and then this one is pretty good in terms of the support from the community as well. And then we are actually using it. And then I recommend whoever actually using for the backend, like for deploying anything, or for you trying to get access to the staging server or productions from the same terminal, yeah, I recommend using SUP. It has a very nice configuration file, which is YAML, so it's very easy to learn, and you don't even have to know anything about Go or anything. It's just an executable file that you just basically run, and it just works. So I love this kind of, like, it's good for all the DevOps and also whoever actually works with the system. Yeah.
Okay, cool. And that's available at GitHub/Presley/SUP, S-U-P.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, cool. Kevin?
Yeah, I've got two picks. One's an article interviewing Christopher Chedeau on his core philosophies of React Native. That's a great read. I'll paste that in the show notes. And the other is a project called Serverless. Serverless is a framework that came out earlier in the year, midsummer, and it was called JAWS, which stood for JavaScript on AWS. But they've rebranded as Serverless. And I'm experimenting with it and also contributing to it because it uses Amazon Lambda functions that are on AWS. Those functions run Node code. So if you need to do some compute and talk to a database or literally compute something, you can put this up on that Lambda structure and not have to fire up servers. This project adds a lot of tooling around interfacing with the Lambda service. Right now, it's a bit clunky in the Amazon UI in that you have to upload a zip file. You have to go to the CloudFormation and build templates, and this simplifies that greatly. So it's on GitHub, github.com/serverless, and they're doing a lot of interesting work. So this would be something that you may be interested in to power your React Native projects without having to spin up a lot of servers. That's it.
Cool.
Okay, Peter?
I was on the TaskRabbit engineering blog website, and it came about this article by Brian Larinard called React Native Launch. It was basically their experience using React Native over iOS, and he just talks about how much more productive their team was, a lot of the snags they ran into, and then just like a breakdown of how many files they were able to reuse across platforms, how much of it is written in JavaScript or C, and a lot of other great statistics. Check it out. Just Google React Native Launch on TaskRabbit.
That's pretty cool.
All right. My pick is going to be a book by Cal Simpson. It's part of the You Don't Know JS series. It's ES6 and Beyond, and I started reading it this weekend. And no matter how much I thought I knew about ES6, there's just a lot of good information there. And you can either buy it on O'Reilly or Amazon, or you can go to his GitHub repo at Gitify. I think he has most of the book there also. But I would actually recommend buying it because it's been one of the better books that I've read over the last year or two, I would say. A lot of information. So, all right. Well, that wraps up episode 14 of React Native Radio. Ali, thank you for coming on our podcast, and hopefully we can have you on again.
Thank you so much for having me.